And then I woke up in a ship and there was a little green man. He was talking to me and then they touched my eyeballs.
In one of those first shows, I played some new songs and this woman came up to me afterwards and said, "Hi, I'm Lynn Grossman. I work with Grey's Anatomy. And would you mind if that first song you played, do you think I could submit it for one of their shows?"
All right. I burped first. We can start here.
Perfect.
Welcome back, guys. Welcome to the new week, the next episode of Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. I'm your host, Jordan Prince, and here next to me is my co-host and producer of this lovely show, Mo Despacharda.
Hello, 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 hello.
Mo, do you... let me actually phrase it like this. I was going to ask you a question, but now I just thought about this. The sun in the afternoon here, and especially in Munich, is so intense. I feel like it almost kind of singes the skin a little bit. And I always feel this kind of dryness in my eyes. I really like it. It feels good and stuff, but that's always like this first moment. I'm like, ooh, that's really like hitting strong. And I wonder actually if it's in connection to the fact that right now at this school job, it's the emergency care. And so it's not like normal school where you have like normal classrooms and you have like the systematic breaks throughout the day, but right now there's someone sick. So like my classroom partner is replacing them. So we're alone the whole day. And so I have, I don't know, just a few kids and they're pretty cool, but the room that they put us in isn't even on the main floor with windows. It's in the basement and it's the last room down the hallway. And it has, I guess you could technically say it has a window, but you know, when you're walking on a sidewalk and you step over one of these metal, like water drains.
And that's how the windows build.
Yeah. So if you open that window, you can put your arm out maybe like from elbow to hand and touch the wall.
Yeah. And so then it goes straight up.
It goes straight up to the grate. So you're looking at a wall and you don't get any sunlight.
Damn.
So it's really damp and dungeony, and there's so many spider webs down there and like dead bugs everywhere and dirt for some reason. Like, I guess they don't clean it that much. And
within the room or within this little
hole? All, like in there, of course, they wouldn't clean that too much, but also like on the floor, it's just kind of weird and damp. And you only have these like five or six really strong white fluorescent lights, like in an office. You have one gray table and for some reason there's just a piano in there. So you just have this kind of vague room. And then, you know, the kids, they Zoom their lessons, even though they're at school. So the thing is they have like group, let's say for example, group one goes to their classroom on this week and group two would be mine. And we'd be downstairs Zooming in the lessons and being at the school, but not a part of the classroom.
Okay.
And then the next week they switch. So I get like five or six of the emergency care kids with me all day in the basement and the other ones would join the class upstairs. It's really weird. I don't actually get the system entirely. Okay. Because the kids all kind of cross paths with each other anyway throughout the day. So I think they could just wear masks and be in the classroom. But anyway, I'm in this dark, weird, fluorescent room all day and we have laptops. So the kids, you know, they Zoom, but then when they finish their homework, they want to either watch something or play video games. So you get really wrapped up in looking at the screen a lot. And of course you're bored. You're super bored. So you're also looking at the laptop, checking emails, looking at Reddit. Sometimes you have nothing to do at all. So you even play a game with them. You look at your phone, you check messages, you look at Instagram, you look at TikTok, whatever, everything. And, you know, we don't switch upstairs until almost 2 o'clock. So the last hour and a half at school, I'm upstairs. The first, I don't know, six, I'm downstairs.
So that's the first time when you actually get some sunlight.
Yeah. So it's even, yeah, exactly. So like when I finally come home, my window is facing, I think, northwest or southwest, but really west. So all that afternoon sunlight just beams in. And when I go on the balcony, like I'm finally getting like this huge hit of sunlight that I don't have for most of my day.
Yeah.
And it feels crazy. It feels really like extra. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I totally feel that because I don't know, I never had this before, but since I have a full-time job and I have an office where I don't let that much sunlight in. I let the thing down. How do you call it?
Like the blinds. You drop the blinds down.
I drop the blinds down because when I do video editing, etc., I have to have a clear sight on my screen.
Yeah.
And so it's weird because at university I never had this, and in school not, because there you would always be in my case in rooms where you get a lot of light, and you also wear shorts there, and it's warm during the day. And now I'm in a situation where I realize how warm it is outside when I go outside for a cigarette or whatever.
Right.
And in between, it's like, okay, this could be, I don't know, April. It could be July. Obviously, it's a little bit warmer in there. Same with studios, which are isolated so well. And that's weird. So I totally get the point that you have another realization of getting sunlight and actually getting how the situation is outside within a day when you get off work.
Yeah, it's just hitting like a little bit harder. But we have such an awesome show today. We have a really, really great guest coming up. Really, really great musician. I don't want to spoil anything.
Fun fact, we already have done this interview. And we still don't know the actual name of our guest.
she's got a stage name that actually she developed when she was a little girl. And you're going to hear all about that later. We just did the interview and we're really happy with it. And you're going to love the show. It's so such a great interview. We really had a lot of fun. And actually today we're doing this, you know, last week we did the jumbo special in Moritz's apartment, and today we're doing it in my apartment. Welcome to my home, by the way.
It's super nice to be here, and I just thought about it. I guess it's the first time within 2020 that I am actually here.
Yeah.
Because actually, the last time we met was in February, like we mentioned last episode.
Yeah.
But that was somewhere at the radio station. And I guess I've not been at your apartment before this day within this year, which is super crazy.
I guess the last time you were here was either, I guess it must have been my birthday party.
Yeah, I guess.
Oh man, that was November. Wow, that was so long ago. That's really wild.
But I always love to be here because Jordan lives in this great apartment where you get so much light and as a pretty cozy kitchen / living room, and we're recording on a pretty comfortable couch. It's just great to be here.
That's the benefit, really. I really like doing podcasts in this scenario where we can sit comfortably on the sofa. You know, we can like look at each other. We can kind of just chill, and you know, we have our water and we have our drinks, and doing it from here always feels really cozy. Like, it's funny too because the last I don't know, like 1,000 episodes that we've done where we weren't together. I was always here at home, but I was actually in the bedroom for all of them. But it's the same idea. Like, I think there's going to be so many jobs and so many professions and so many hobbies that people have had to manipulate into being able to do it at home. And now they realize how comfortable and safe and, you know, how easy it would also be to do these certain jobs and stuff from home, that I think even when Corona has a vaccine, people are going to probably fight to keep that position, you know?
Yeah. And same for us. I think as long as we have our little technical setup, which we could take at any place.
Dude, I mean,
it's super easy.
The gear you have here is perfect for traveling anywhere. It's just like a mic arm. I mean, I have my own mic and stand here, but you know, you have that too. And like this great little interface here.
Yeah. And one laptop, and there we go.
That's all you need. It's perfect. Is your laptop storing the data of this podcast on its own, or do you have a drive?
Also? I have a drive connected to it. I could also save it on the laptop, but
it's a big file.
It's a big file, and I'm doing many different video and audio projects, and this laptop has not that many internal storage, so. Yeah. We do directly record to a hard drive, basically.
Yeah, that's also what I'm doing with when we do my track here. I was going to ask you, actually, you have a MacBook.
Yes.
How old is this?
3 years. So, but it's been manufactured in 2015, but I bought it new in 2017.
Okay. And so it should still work pretty great, right? Like, do you have a lot of problems with it at all?
Not really. Slowly, battery...
battery always. Apple loves that.
Battery plus I get in trouble when I do video projects because this is the... we do a lot of Mac name dropping. It's the MacBook Air, which is basically...
They should sponsor us.
which is basically kind of a student's laptop and doesn't have that much... it's not really made for big data and video editing, etc. So audio editing and Photoshop, etc. runs pretty good, and all of the other things all the office programs you could need. But video editing, etc., is really a challenge to do on this thing.
Yeah, I can totally imagine that. My laptop is extremely old, man. I need to put some money aside and just get the new one. That's what Ify's always telling me to do. But it's from, I got it in college. I got it in like 2009 or 10.
What?
So it's already somewhere between 10 or 11 years old.
Crazy.
Right. That's nuts. Like in today's, you know, fast paced technological switcheroo.
Everyone has a new phone every 2 years, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I'm the worst with phones as well. Like I really won't go through the process of getting a new one until mine's crumbling apart in my hands and I can't make any calls or anything with it. But the laptop, strangely enough, the biggest issue it has, of course, is battery. So that's really annoying if I have to travel with it because it's just an unusable block that takes up space until I plug it in the wall.
Yeah.
And even that isn't good enough because what I have to do now is twist the power cable into this perfect little pretzel knot and then like hold it and then bend it and then shove it and then hope that it tells me the truth on the battery chart. Because if it doesn't say what I think it's supposed to say, then if I'm not paying attention to it, then I'll think, okay, that makes sense. It should be around like 64%. But then maybe I'm not paying attention to if the battery's climbing up or not. And then after like, 45 minutes, maybe I'm like in the middle of an email or I'm watching something, the computer will just shut down. It'll just die completely. And then I have to hope that the next configuration I make of that knot is the right one to even turn it back on. And especially if you're doing something that you weren't sure if it's saved, if you're updating your website or anything that's like relatively important. Maybe you're looking at something on Google Drive, like you're sharing a file with somebody and it's just like, pew, then you're just, I hope it's saved. I hope it shared it. And then you have to do the right configuration. Then you finally get it. And then your battery or my battery will say like, it'll be back at 0%. And then everything is so slow.
By the way,
it's crazy.
That's a problem with the newer ones like I have, but these older MacBooks are pretty easy to open, or you find someone who's doing it professionally, but you could basically easily put in a new battery or a new drive or something.
So the older ones are easier to open than these.
Yeah, to open and to upgrade the single parts of it.
Oh man, Ify's gonna love to hear that because I was always like, no, it's an Apple. It's so hard to crack into. It's so hard to change everything. I was like, I don't know if it's just the power cable. I can't just buy a new power cable because maybe it's the battery. But then maybe it's the battery, not the power cable. So then I'd have to get both for sure. But I wonder, do you know how much like an average Apple or MacBook Air battery costs?
I don't know.
It can't be that much.
It can't be that much. I guess... because a friend of mine did this with a MacBook Pro from 2011, I guess, 2 years ago, and it worked out pretty well. And he told me it's not that hard and not that expensive. You only have to find a guy you can trust who does it. So you have to Google the parts.
Yeah.
And find someone who knows what he or she's doing.
Oh, but see, I think that's the hard part, like with anything, is finding the guy you can trust to do it. Yeah. I wanted to tell you a little bit about yesterday evening. So for those listening abroad, especially if anyone's listening in America, I'm really sorry to disappoint you with this story, but this huge water park opened back in Munich yesterday. I mean, the numbers, I haven't really checked the current Corona map. I mean, do you know from Bavaria?
Only for Germany, and that being pretty vague, so no concrete numbers.
Okay, but still, like, it's at a flattened enough curve for what they're allowing right now.
Yeah.
I mean, if any place is really strict about what they allow and don't allow, it's going to be Germany.
And especially Bavaria.
And especially Bavaria. And honestly, with the pandemic, I'm really thankful for that. Because I don't have to worry when a water park opens up that they've made a dumb decision. I can be like, oh my God, finally.
Yeah.
We've crossed enough of these humongous, strict red lines where that's allowed again, you know? Unlike in America, where did you see that they're opening up Disneyland in Florida?
Yeah, but only for the NBA.
Only for the NBA?
In what? Orlando.
It's only for the NBA?
As far as I know. In Orlando, that's the they call it the Orlando bubble, because they're going to restart the NBA there from July 30th on until mid of October. I can't imagine that they let other people in there.
Oh, okay. Then I really misunderstood that article.
But Disneyland Paris reopened. That's what I saw advertising on Twitter.
What opened in Paris?
Disneyland Paris reopened.
Oh,
or
okay.
Is about to reopen this week or something.
I didn't even know there was a Disneyland in Paris. Man, they're everywhere. But yeah, okay. Then I really misunderstood what they're allowing, because the internet's exploding right now with the fact that the America is the epicenter of this disease.
And especially Florida.
Especially Florida, which had like, what, 50,000 in a week or something? Or a maybe day. That was Texas? Yeah. It's so crazy. I can't even keep up with it. There's over 3 million cases, and people are arguing that, you know, wearing the mask is like restricting their freedoms or something. And they're like, yeah, let's open up Disneyland, where like so many people are dying every single day. You know, it's crazy too. I listened to the new Joe Rogan with Hannibal Buress, and they were talking about how, you know, and I have a friend, actually my friend Josh, who's for personal experience had Corona. And you know, it's really not just these people think it's like, it's, they really think it's just a flu, but it's also fucking with your brain. People are having like no symptoms at all who have it, testing positive, showing relative to no symptoms, and then still developing a really intense and debilitating brain disorders connected to the coronavirus. And they're not sure how it's, why it's doing it or how they can stop it. So people think it's just like, oh, I have a cough and I have a fever, but it's, my friend Josh, for example, like he had these popular symptoms for a while, and then he healed. But now he's having like really bad insomniatic issues connected to his like night breathing, and he's I don't know. I forgot everything that he was going through right now, but it's really hard for him. And it's been quite some time since he got through the roughest symptoms, but anyway, I read somewhere that Disneyland was reopening, and someone made a joke where they were like, the new ride at Disneyland takes you directly to the intensive care unit. I mean, it's so insane that they're doing that.
Yeah.
Long story short, I went to a water park in Munich last night.
How was it?
I almost forgot my point. Wow. So I went with my friend, Gabby. She's from Australia, and she lives here in Munich too. And we took this long train and this medium length bus, and it was totally worth the travel, because when we got there, man, it was just like the old days. It was so crazy to be inside this place, because once you cross...
But how many people would they let in?
As far as I know, they didn't have like a... I mean, probably they had...
No restrictions at all?
I didn't see any. They didn't give us like a number stamp or something. Okay. But maybe they keep a number. I mean, you know, when you go to restaurants here, you have to sign the thing at the table. So we had to do that. We had to say, obviously, you know, party of two, my name, whatever. But they didn't. there weren't any signs anywhere that said how many people they could let in, but I'm not sure. But it felt, you know, it wasn't insanely packed, but that could also be because it was a Monday evening. It was just like the old days. It was a lot of people, but I didn't feel uncomfortable. And you could just access everything. And once you got through the locker rooms, you didn't have to wear a mask.
Okay.
Because we had a theory like, okay, are we going to go through there and they're going to make us wear...
A mask in the water?
Yeah, I thought that. Or like some sort of like waterproof thing you wear. Like, we didn't know what to expect. Honestly, you just don't know what to expect anymore.
Yeah.
So, but once you got through the locker room, that's it. Then you just, you wear your little locker key on your wrist and you go through. And yeah, we swam in the big pool that leads to the outside pool for a while. And that was so nice. And then we walked through and, you know, they had the longest water slide in the world. We took that like six times. It's so much fun. We took a bunch of different slides and then we went over to the wave pool. We swam in there for, I don't know, 20 minutes, but then she got a little bit dizzy. So we got out and then like I grabbed a pizza slice and she grabbed some fries and some chicken nuggets. And, she had like a Coca-Cola flavored slushy and it was just like, we're back in America, baby. It was great. We spent 2.5 hours there, maybe just a little under that. And, honestly, to be in there with a lot of people and no mask and having fun and then coming back out into the real world with the mask on the bus and on the train and back in the train stations and stuff. It's so strange. It felt like the pool world was the real world and outside of it was the weird, like, dystopia.
But one could argue it is that way. Because the world you experience there is the world we're used to and we used to live in for our whole lives.
That's true. It felt really like home. It was like, we can just like have fun. I mean, maybe that's the temptation that so many Americans have. You know, they like can't fathom the first part, the hard part.
Yeah.
They're like not willing to give up that idea of what they're used to. But honestly, I'm so thankful they're doing that. And I saw like there's a venue in Munich, the Import Export is doing a singer-songwriter evening tomorrow and they're going to do an open air where you can still jam, you can still, you know, like showcase music to other people and meet musicians and stuff, like with distancing and stuff and masks, but still you're doing it. You're outside, you're with people, you're jamming. And it's like, man, it's been a long time since I saw that.
No.
It's so crazy.
But the for me, still the weirdest thing or the one thought where I realize how weird the whole situation is how seasons do not matter anymore. At least in my case, it doesn't feel like it is summer.
Right.
It's like, okay, the thing is, the last day before I experienced any form of restrictions was a day where I was skiing, and it was a beautiful winter day in the second week of March.
Mm-hmm.
And then this whole thing started. I basically missed most of spring. It is summer, but it still, I don't know, because it's lost in this transition of seasons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think yesterday at this water park and maybe one other day also with Gabby coincidentally was probably, there was a weekend where this 4th of July weekend we talked about on the last episode. Yeah. I would say those two events that weekend and this water park were the first and only two times thus far where I recognized the season that we're in, because we were out and it was hot and there was like a body of water nearby and the whole purpose was to lay in or around it. And I was like, oh, it is summer. Because it's so often in Munich too, I get to like, you know, October 1st, because it will happen in the blink of an eye. And I'm going to be like, oh man, I kept preparing for summer and looking for summer, and now summer's over.
Yeah.
But even worse so now with the virus, like you talk about, the entirety of like end of winter, late spring was, you know, staying inside. All the jobs were weird and everything was all about the virus. And like you just stayed. Oh, our neighborhood cat Rufus is at the window. Hi, Rufus.
This is Rufus?
Yeah, it's Rufus.
He's a big boy.
He's a big fat neighborhood cat. He's like the man about town.
He has a weird mustache.
He has a little bit of a Hitler mustache, I gotta say.
I was thinking about us. Since this is not a video podcast, you gotta imagine a mixed black and white cat with beautiful fur, but it's his lower face is completely white, but he has this little black block of fur underneath his nose.
He's got a little Hitler stash, you know?
Crazy Rufus.
What if Rufus is so a neo-Nazi? Oh man. No, Rufus, like, he's all around. Like someone owns him. He's an old fat black and white cat.
Is his actual name Rufus?
Is this really what you call him?
Rufus.
Yeah. He's someone owns him around here somewhere.
What about your cat?
They're both gone, man. I mean, you know, the black cat died.
Yeah.
And then the girl cat we had here was gone for 10 months.
And then she came back. That's the last thing I heard.
Yeah. So she came back. It was a miracle. We had her for, I think she was back for, I would say not that long, maybe 3 months, maybe a little bit more, but it felt really fast. And then she disappeared again, because, you know, the thing is, we had her inside for a long time. But she's a cat that's already experienced outside. Okay. So you have to raise a cat indoors if you want an indoors cat who doesn't care about outside. Yeah. That's at least what I'm used to. And then, or you have a cat that's both. So she's already used to being both. And yeah, we bought an extra tracker. We bought her a new collar. There's like a chip in her. There's a QR code on the collar. There's like every way of like finding out if someone has her. And we haven't heard anything in months, man. Like since... Actually, it was still lockdown. It was like the week. Yeah. Like maybe she's been gone for like 3 months already. And she went out her little cat flap door and she disappeared. We haven't heard anything from anybody. We don't know where she is. So funny thing was, though, we miss having an animal in the apartment so much that Rufus, he gets in a lot. He gets in our apartment a lot, and he's always jumping. So like, our balcony leads into this kind of, I know in German it's like Innenhof, right?
Yeah.
But I think in English you'd say, maybe like so like the apartment building makes, let's imagine like the letter U and then the inside of that U. So like a little garden, shared grassy garden area. And that grassy garden area, you have to hop a fence to get to the neighbor and then you can go into the whole city. So I think a lot of cats do that. We see 4 or 5 cats who circle around this area a lot. And Rufus is sort of like I think of him as like the neighborhood pimp. He's just kind of like sluggish and like attitude. And he's like, what's up, player? You know, he's just like super chill. And I think he comes here a lot to this corner. I don't know if he was friends with our cat or what, but if we leave the front door open for any moment of time, he's usually in the hallway already, or he's hanging out in the balcony. So if we crack the door open for some air, he always comes in. And, you know, I've kicked him out of this apartment probably 50 times. And still, he always finds his way back in. He finds it kind of like a home. And one day, we left the door cracked, but we kind of forgot about it. We closed the blinds down to, like, foot level. And we had the door, like, cracked open. And we just forgot about it. And hold on, I'm turning my...
Hi.
I think that was me.
I'm not sure.
Some phone crackles. I think I just turned my phone off. But Yeah, we left the door cracked. We had the blinds down. And the next morning we got up and I was making coffee and I turned around and here on this sofa, Rufus was on that big comfy blanket right there and he was spread out. He was so relaxed.
Don't mind me. Just crashed on your couch.
He didn't even freak out. Like
he didn't even say something.
He didn't even ask, bro. You should just text me next time. He didn't even move. He didn't even blink his eyes and say, you know, he didn't like, oh my God, they realized like, I've thrown him out a lot and I saw him and he just kind of like, you know, wiggled and stretched. He kept his eyes closed the whole time. So finally we had to take him out, but I saw him there like super cozy. And I looked at Efi and I was like, I miss having a cat there, you know?
Yeah. I also love cats. And, you know, Tony's moving in at my place
right
this fall. And we thought about pets, but the mm-hmm. thing is, the apartment is not that big. Might be, yeah. Just imagine your apartment. You know it, but
yeah.
A 2-room apartment, and those 2 rooms are not that small. But 2-room apartment, kitchen, bathroom. But it is in the 3rd floor.
Right.
So what kind of pet could you keep in there? I don't know. Yeah. I don't think a cat would be a cool idea. For a cat, I think it wouldn't be a proper living situation.
Right.
So what kind of pet can you have? Maybe fish or a hamster?
I mean, that's the problem, right? I think I don't know how abusive for animals this actually is, because I think it's so quintessential American to raise certain breeds of cats inside. Because then they don't have this urgency. I had this discussion a lot with Efi, of course, about like they don't have this urgency to want to be outside.
Okay.
So they don't like scratch at the door and like, you know, they don't have this thing of like crying for hours and hours and hours like our cats did because they had been outside so much.
No.
But I think apartment cats in America are so common. But maybe this is just another cultural difference.
Like, I don't know, but I gotta admit I don't know anything about raising cats.
Yeah. I mean,
do you think it could be like, it could be cool for a cat or even possible for a cat to be living in an apartment like mine?
And yours for sure, just because like it's not humongous, but you have, it's not one square. So many apartments are just one square. And I think that can be kind of like a prison cell for cats. But you have like, you have this Z, you know, you have like, the door comes in, you have kitchen on your right, turn right, hallway, you have like bedroom, turn left, you have bathroom, and then other bedroom. So the cat can kind of like adventure into these little apartments and or these little compartments inside the apartment. And if a cat is raised very small inside that space, that is their whole world. So they get really used to it. As far as I know, I mean, you have to imagine in New York and stuff, in LA, these major cities, millions of people have cats that are only inside cats. But I don't know, Efi and I disagreed on that because she wanted to get another cat. And I said, okay, we should just raise it as an inside cat. That way we don't lose another animal.
Yeah.
And then her argument was really fair. She just didn't agree with it. She said that, you know, they want to be outside. They belong outside. She grew up with a cat, of course. That
yeah,
was
but
outside.
In a little village where...
Exactly. Exactly. And that's just a different world. You know, like when I grew up, I had inside dog. My mom still has an inside dog. And we also had an outside dog. And we had several cats that were, you know, it was like one cat we had inside, outside. Then she gave birth and then she died. And then we had like one kitten that was like inside, outside, one kitten that was only inside. We just had always had like several animals in and around the house, but that one cat and that one dog were only inside and they never had any issues. With the cats, you know, that's the one thing though, if you want to have a cat inside, is like you have to adapt to that litter box life.
Yeah.
You know, but that's really easy to do. And if you have the right powder and you put the box in a certain place, like the smell is no problem and you just clean it out once a day. Or depending, whatever, twice a day. But that's really, for me, that was no... I got used to that really fast. But I'm used to pets.
Yeah. I am as well, but in a whole nother situation. As a country boy, I used to grow up with pets who were obviously always outside pets, like you mentioned. And it wasn't even as a kid, it wasn't even in my mind that there could be only inside pets. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it is still a strange idea for me. And if someone who really knows about those things would say to me, okay, you can have a cat within this flat, and if it's used to it, it's no big deal, and they do not suffer, or the cat doesn't suffer from it, it's right. Totally cool. I would go out and buy a cat.
For me, I mean, the thing is, I think it just comes down to how you feel about it. If you grow up a certain way and you feel weird about it, then I for me, it's like, okay, you don't want to have any guilt about this pet. So if you feel weird about it, that's okay. You don't have to do it. In my case, I saw it so much in America that's something I'm used to.
Yeah.
So I would have no problem if she brought a kitten home, or a small dog today, like the dog, you have to walk, of course, that's fine. But the cat, like, can totally live inside. And I've seen it so much. I don't know. We're probably going to have some European listeners who really, really disagree with this. But I think it's just a cultural thing. Like, I think that is something that cats are really good at adapting to.
No.
But there's just different ways of seeing it.
The second fact is that I'm not quite sure if I am, regarding my landlord, if I'm allowed to have a pet within this apartment.
In those rules,
a pet within the flat.
In those rules where people in Germany say you can't have a pet, does that also mean you couldn't have like a little, like a fishbowl?
I guess you could have that. I think there is a kind of a rule, a paragraph that defines that you're not allowed to have any pets that make noise, dirt, or whatever. You know what
right.
I mean?
They can't just like, they can't smell and have fur everywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Because I guess they wouldn't make a rule about that for things that don't even affect anybody. Like, you're keeping them alive in this little tiny ecosystem, you know? Oh, man. Oh, I wanted to ask you, actually, if you've started this show on Netflix called Unsolved Mysteries.
Nope, I didn't.
You should do that. It's really good. It's really cool.
Okay.
Unsolved Mysteries was this extremely popular show in America. And our guest, we didn't talk about it with her, but I know she knows what this is. But very popular show in the 80s and 90s. And it was called Unsolved Mysteries. And it had this really great host. He looked a little bit maybe like Michael Douglas a little bit. He had this amazing voice, and you know, it was just this classic style where he would, like, you know, sit with like one leg on a desk and talk to the camera directly.
Is it this guy who they made a lot of memes about?
No, not him.
No.
That guy's always like, it never happened.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another great show. That was such a great show. What was that called? That guy had black hair and a beard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That show's also really awesome. They would do three reenactments.
Yeah.
And only one of them was true. And you had to guess which one was true. That was a really fun show. But this one was actual Unsolved Mysteries. And the show ran for a long time. And there's actually some controversy about it, because they would do a lot of true crime. Like, this person went to a party and disappeared. And they would do the whole story about, like, all the evidence they could find, all the interviews that they could do, and talk to all the cops, the family, everything. And then at the end, I mean, it's just an unsolved mystery. They would just give you all the information they could, and they'd say, like, if you know anything, you know, please call this number. So every true crime case, the murders, the disappearances, the kidnappings, the rapes, everything, they would just put all the information that they could. It was such a gripping story. And then they would, at the end, they would say, like, if you have any information about this crime, please go to this website. But the thing that they got controversy for in the old days was that they, and this is interesting about how Netflix handled this, they would sprinkle in these really interesting kind of conspiratorial stories, like kind of sci-fi stories, mm-hmm. specifically like alien abductions.
Classic.
So they would have, you know, they would mix in these real stories of like grieving families looking for their, you know, missing son. And then the next story would be like Andrew was a 35-year-old comic book designer who one night had a disturbance he did not expect. It'd be like, man, I woke up in my bed and there was this big white light and it was just shining real bright on me. And I was rubbing my eyes and I was thinking, man, well, now what the heck is that? It's real late in the evening for me. I got to work in the morning. And then all of a sudden I heard this voice in my head and it said, just breathe. And then I took a breath and then I realized I was completely naked and I was lying here on a... Are we still recording? Yes. Okay. And then he's like, oh, then I woke up in a ship and there was a little green man. He was talking to me and then they touched my eyeballs and then they put their fingers in my armpits and gave me whispers from God. And then he like wakes up in a cornfield, like, you know, 10 miles down the road. And it was just crazy stories. Like some of them, of course, engaging. I like conspiracy theories. I like talking about aliens. I think I'd get along with Joe Rogan, basically. And yeah, I love that stuff. And there were some interesting ones, but also some so stupid ones. Of course, they mix in like, you know, it's just whatever sells. And they got a lot of backlash for mixing in like grieving families' true stories with people's like completely unprovable, you know, encounters with aliens. And I like how Netflix handled that tradition that they did.
But so did Netflix set up new episodes in that style or did they just play the old episodes?
No, they don't play the old episodes. They rebooted it completely.
Okay.
There's only 6 episodes, I think, right now. And they do it in the classic Netflix true crime style.
Okay.
So really gritty, really like beautiful, you know, David Fincher-esque cinematography. And they, it's the same producers from Stranger Things.
Ah, okay.
So it's really, really like serious and like beautiful colors and really nice tone and everything. And it's the same idea. There's no host, but you see glimpses of him in the opening credits, like to give homage to him. But the 4 or 5 of them that are true crime, like disappearances, murders, it's really like perfectly constructed, you know, 45-minute, 50-minute long stories and testimonials of like the family, the police, the town locals, and they give you all the information they can. And in the end, it says like, if you know anything about the, I think the one I saw today was about Alonzo Brooks, this disappearance in 2004. And they're like, if you know anything about, you know, Alonzo Brooks or, you know, his, kidnappers or his abusers, and, you know, go to this website. And then there's one out of the 6 that's about aliens.
Okay.
But they do it in that Netflix way. You know, they do it in the whole like really serious tone, really good, creepy music. And honestly, I have to say, it's not the like kookiest alien story I've ever heard.
Okay.
It's actually kind of like, because it affects so many people so far apart that you really have to question like, okay, either this did happen
or they did script it.
No, I would say, or there was another like completely unrelated strange phenomenon.
Okay.
With like, I don't know, this weird coincidental nightmare connection between a certain people in a certain state. But yeah, I would say watch it.
That's what I'm going to do. And I would say, you guys go listen and let's get back to an amazing conversation and interview we had.
With
our guest whose real name we still don't know yet. But
I think at this point I don't even want to know. But I want to say... that this is a really great interview. Her name is Miko. She's a lovely person to talk to. She has really, really great insight on a lot of things. She's been around the world and I think you're going to learn a lot. You're going to really like her. So really finish all the way through. Thank you so much for listening. And here she is. Mikko, it's actually really nice to meet you because I heard about you from, we share a similar connection to this record label in Hamburg, Pop-Up.
Oh, cool. How?
And well, right now I'm using their PR services for this. So I'm releasing, I just did a single in May and I have another one, I think we said maybe November, and then a new album in January. And I was working with them for like, distributing it and like using their assistance to get some better PR with it and stuff. Because everything I had done before this was always independent. And I just felt like I needed a little extra help to get to, potentially some next step. So I looked, I had written with them for a while, then we set up a connection. But I don't know too much about your working relationship with them. I just know I was writing with Ina. And she like flat out just recommended you as a guest. She said she checked out the show and she liked how we did it and stuff. And then she said, I have this friend. I originally read it as Maiko, of course, because of Germany, but I'll get to that. And she said, yeah, this is a great artist on the label and you should get her on the show. And then that's how we started our correspondence. How do you know Pop-Up, or how long have you worked with them?
I was introduced to them from a friend of a friend. When I first moved to, I've lived in Germany for 2 years and I've lived in Hamburg for 2 years. And, I have a little bit of stuff going on in America and I know that I don't have much going on here. So I wanted to, that was my goal moving here, just trying to get a little something going, I just wanted to play shows and I noticed that the scene was a little hard to get into here, especially because I don't speak German. And so yes, it's a very yes, tiny yeah. bubble. So I was introduced to Pop-Up Records and they've been amazing. My mind's actually been blown by some of the things they've made happen. They've gotten my songs on radio and, they're getting lots of press stuff, physical press stuff, which is really cool to see. And I like that they're a small but mighty label. Yeah. So
that's a really good description, the small but mighty. Yeah. I felt the same way. Like I've been in Germany now for, okay. So you've been in Hamburg for two. I've been in Munich for this is the fifth year now. And I can totally relate to you in this way of like, it was extremely hard to crack into the scene. And like, of course, language is such a huge part of it. And then, I think what we think Americans or like British people want to hear, or like, I don't know, the more west side of the world, what they want to hear, we kind of have a vague idea of, or like we're closer to tapping into that because we're from there. And then living here, I was introduced to like, this old standard German pop, this Schlager, which is for me sometimes so hard to digest. Like, how did people get so into this? And you have to see it from like a cultural standpoint to understand it. And then you're like, okay, now I get it. And then I just didn't get, like what the other artists here were doing for a long time. And I was just grinding like all the time when I first came here. Like, so I'm from New Orleans and I had had three projects there. It's like, have you played in New Orleans before? Okay. House of Blues. Yeah. Okay. That's a great venue. So I had lived there for a long time and I had three different projects and I was going to this like music and film university and I was super ingrained in that community. And I don't know how much you know about it, but it's just such a musical heavy city. Like, everyone's a musician and they're all really good. And it's crazy to blend and mix all these genres. And then when I moved here, I lost all of that, had to start fresh, and then was looking into, all these open mics and stuff and trying to meet musicians that way. And it just took so long. I mean, what was your first year like in terms of finding gigs and finding opportunities?
It was really slow going. I think after the first year, that was the the anniversary. My first anniversary here was like, okay, you really need to like make more of an effort. Because I got my start in America in LA. I was going to open mic nights every week And nobody knew who I was. And it was a process where I was the people who were putting on the open mic nights, they asked me to play an actual show at the venue. And then that's how you kind of get in. And then someone hears you and says, oh, I have this thing. You know, you just play anywhere and everywhere, but you have to be heard to get to those places. So I came here thinking like, oh, that's easy. I'll just go to open mic nights. Someone will hear me. They'll ask me to play. And then like, it'll all be just like America. Like that's how, like, I know it so well in America. I know that grind, that I felt pretty confident that it was going to happen here. Also, I'm a girly voice on guitar, and I think that they really like singer-songwriters here. So I was like, easy peasy. But it was not at all. It didn't just fall into my lap. And after the first year, I was like, I have to do the grind, but also, I mean, really the idea is to learn German so I can really, really connect, because now, or at least somewhat connect.
Have you had the occasional person come up and ask you if you would write songs in German?
I think so. I feel like I've had that question, but it's funny that a lot of the German artists I see are writing songs in English, which I think I would much rather hear, even though I'm not going to understand exactly what you're saying, but as a native, you want to hear the language from the person's language. That's like me trying to write a song in German, and not, you know, just getting a context off. And, I guess some people do it right. But, in these open mic nights where I'm hearing people's new songs and stuff, I'm hearing, words misused and, you know,
dude, all of the time,
should I tell them that they're not saying the right things in English? But also more power to them for that being something they want to do. So, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I don't want to be an asshole about it, but,
I can completely connect, you know, and there's this band that's like between, Switzerland and Munich, kind of in, they're kind of a mixed couple style, but they're, in my definition of the people I've met here, they're extremely German. And then they're singing, in English to try and get, you know, more of an international appeal. And it's the same exact thing that you just mentioned where you, you hear the misuse of things and you kind of twist in your ear a little bit, but you feel that you can't really say anything. They even asked me for the last record they did for like two of the songs, and there was another really great British artist that we've actually had on the show before, to write some English text for them. And then I did, and then they brought it back and they had said, okay, well, we wanted to change some things for how it rolls off the tongue. And I was like, of course, that makes sense. And they had switched some things to for it to feel good on their palate, but then it didn't make sense anymore. And I was like, it's good. That's all right.
It's even cringy from the when you look at this from the other side, because I have played in bands where we had English lyrics, and I'm not a native speaker. I'm from Germany, and we played shows where there were other artists from English speaking countries, and I guess I missed a lot of opportunities to get up to those guys and talk to them about their experience and maybe just connecting, because I felt so awkward about singing songs in English while there is someone who obviously might know better than us 16-year-old German guys.
Right.
It's funny. But I mean, also, like, that's pretty amazing if you're speaking a second language well enough to write a song.
That's it, right? Yeah.
Exactly. You're feeling confident enough to speak the language, which I am very grateful for, because I'm going around all day like, speaking English, like,
absolutely,
before anything that I need to say, or like, and that really takes the, when you want something spontaneous, you know, you like a girl's dress.
Yes.
Hey, speaking English. Mm-hmm. Oh, your dress is great. Or you're doing awesome. Or like, it just stops. It stops all the emotion.
It stops you.
And then, yeah. So
It's just because I just want to touch on that thing you just said before we. I keep stopping you, but
yeah, sorry. Feel free.
But it's such a great point that you made about how that language barrier stops you from being the person that you're used to being in your native tongue, and it's so hard to cross that barrier. I mean, I'm here 5 years, and I'm doing an English podcast with my German friend. You know what I mean? Like, it's still extremely hard for me to cross that border. And of course, as time goes by, even if you didn't take any lessons, you would just naturally, of course, pick up more of the language, and you do get more confident in certain situations with certain people. But still, like, I just had a conversation with a friend of mine. She's a really lovely teacher at this school. She's from Canada. And she was saying how, you know, she's really feisty, and she's really independent, and she's really, she doesn't want to rely on anybody. She wants to, like, take care of anything at all times and be spontaneous, like you said. And she said she feels so, like, whittled down by this language barrier, and that she can't get to that place where, I mean, for example, you know, she's ordering a package and it's, you know, 8 days late or something. She wants to call the place and say, hey, is it at the parcel center, or is it on the way? What can I do? She has to, like, go to her friend and ask them to talk for her. And I also have to do that when it's really important stuff. And it puts pressure on the person you're asking, and it puts pressure on you. And you feel, for me, it's very emasculating too, to be like, you know, asking my wife or asking another friend to, like, can you please, like, call the tax guy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm my husband, bless him, he's very supportive, and he knows that, like, there has been a sacrifice made by me coming to Germany and you know, starting a new life, even though I'm super down to do it and I wanted to come here, and there's no pressure, but I'm an immigrant, you know? So
you're an artsy fartsy immigrant.
That's
exactly.
Right. Artsy fartsy immigrant. But yeah. And so I'm asking him all the time, like, what does this say? What is, you know, blah, blah, blah. And 2 years, I would think, you know, I would think I would know a lot more after 2 years, but I am proud of some leaps that I've made, but yeah. it brings a lot of light to growing up in America, and people are like, they've been here 20 years, you know, or 10 years, and they don't even speak a lick of English. You know, I'm sure you hear it all the time. Like, you know, speak English, you know, or like people who are get so frustrated with people who aren't speaking English. Right. I understand that when I'm out and I encounter the bread lady who's a total asshole, you know, and I'm like, it's funny because there's some really good bread everywhere. But down the street is where I like to go. And the first experience, I'm like, do you speak English? Like, can I have some bread? Do you have any fluffy white bread? Because I'm pretty homesick.
Can I get some, please, some bread, please? Just, I'm so hungry.
And she's like, nine. You know, she refused to speak English with me. And so I was like, oh man, she's
But like, that's fucking, that should
how
be illegal.
Rude. You know, I was so upset. So then I made myself go back the next day and say, ich hätte gerne Brötchen, bitte. And she was so proud of me. I could see in her face that she almost wanted to smile deep down inside.
Almost.
And so now I...
she almost wanted
to
smile.
I could tell it was there. I saw a glimmer in her eye. But now I think, you know, I kind of just... It was a very small step, but just ordering bread and feeling confident of getting through the whole process of going in, saying good morning, ordering my bread and leaving and knowing how much she was asking me to pay. That's the first step. And I'm kind of just lingering there.
Yeah. You know, we actually talked about this with, maybe you can remember the guest we talked about the plateaus with.
It was more than one guest, but yeah, we talked about it.
We cover that a lot sometimes. But this is like my philosophy about learning, especially just me learning a language, but in terms of like us learning German, there's so many plateaus that you get to, and like you get to this kind of this wall, and you spend so much time with a hammer above your head, like trying to crack the wood to open the next level, and then you finally fucking crack it, and then you can stand on top, and then you're like, oh, okay, I'm there, and it's really going to be hard for me to fall back down there. Like, I'm here for a while. And then the next, you know, like to get to that next one is so hard because I think probably close to where you are now, around the 2 year mark, it sounds like we maybe have a similar connection to that language, but like getting through this A1 level where it's like hellos, goodbyes, I would like, thank you, you know, can you please pass this, or, you know, can you please, whatever, whatever. That stuff, like at first all sounds kind of silly and you start questioning like the format and why they arrange the verbs and the nouns in the way that they do. And it sounds like you can't really connect with it. And then you'll pass that plateau kind of quickly and it'll trick you because then you get to that next one where they want you to do it, you know, conversationally, or, you know, calling someone with a problem, or God forbid you call someone who's not German and they only know how to speak German or their other language, which is not English. And then you're really stuck trying to tough it out, you know? It's a hard thing to get through.
To take one step back, what we know is that you are a musician from the States, living in Hamburg since 2 years, and you're married, but I still want to know, how did it come that you moved to Hamburg?
Okay. Well, let's see. How do I politically correctly say things?
You don't have to.
You just say hey, honestly, I should have told you this before you started. You say whatever you want, and then if you ever double question yourself, you can always write us, and we do editing last minute in case guests get nervous about something.
Thanks. Okay, so I lived in Los Angeles for 14 years. That's where I started my career. That's where I felt most at home thus far. Me and my husband got married and we thought, like, where can we go where we can start a life? Because LA is so expensive. Like, you can't even buy you. When you get married, you know, you want to like have a home. Well, for us, it was like, we wanted to have a home and a backyard, and we were living in this little apartment. And so we're like, where can we buy a house? Okay, Nashville. Like, we thought about all different places. Like, what makes sense where we can be around music, but like it ticks all the boxes. So like, okay, Nashville, music, you know, it's close to family because I'm from Georgia. You know, it's got a major airport. We can fly anywhere we need to. It's a straight flight to London because my husband's half British, he's half American and half German, but he was born and raised in London. Very complex.
Ooh, saucy.
Complex character. So we settled on Nashville. And then, we got married, packed all of our stuff up, moved to Nashville. We were there for about 3 years. And same thing, it was really hard to get my career started there because it's a small bubble and a small circle of musicians. And it was tough.
The competition must be insane there.
It was really tough. And I was like, I came in there very confident because I was like, okay, I've pretty much cracked the code in LA. So how hard can it be to go to Nashville and get in, you know, same language, all that. Right. And it was really, really difficult and it didn't happen. So after 3 years, we had a baby. We were just sitting on the couch, like watching the election. Our son was like, I don't know, a few months old. He was born in July and the election was in November. So that happened and we were like, you know, maybe we go try something else outside of America. Because things were getting really intense, not necessarily like who lost or who won, but it was a lot of division between people and it was a real stress and to be a young family. So we were like, okay, let's go on an adventure. So we bought tickets that night. To go the next summer to spend the summer in Europe because we knew we wanted to live in Europe. So we planned out this crazy trip where we went to London and Berlin and Madrid and I think that's it, Malaga. And then we thought, when we were in Berlin, we had an opportunity to visit a cousin in Hamburg. So we just came to Hamburg for the weekend. And as soon as we got to the main train station, Hauptbahnhof, something was magical. I don't know what, I can't explain it, but something spoke to both of us. And we were like, are you thinking what I'm thinking? Like, let's not talk about it till the end of the trip. And so we couldn't contain ourselves that night. We're like, over wine, we're like, Hamburg might be where it's at. Like, this is like a little village. It's cool. It's good for kids. There's water. There's, you know, yes. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
And yeah, so, yeah, this was pretty much our last place on the, you know, for our trip. And we went back to Nashville and we're like, okay, fuck it. Let's do it. Let's do something crazy. So we packed up all of our stuff. Yeah. We took a year to make the transition and, we just came to Hamburg and every day I swear we feel very lucky. We are like, we wake up in our a little apartment and just say how grateful we are. And we're not cheesy hippie people. I mean, we're kind of hippie, but like, we're not like, oh, I'm so grateful for this, you know, air we breathe. We're not always saying that, but we feel very happy here. So
I'm so actually excited to talk to you about your perception of the great qualities of living in Germany as opposed to the country that we left behind at seemingly the perfect moment.
I know.
By the way, did I get it right? The last presidential elections were the final event that made you say, okay, we're moving out of the state. Not crazy.
It was always something my husband wanted to do because he's half German. His dad's from near Berlin. And we were thinking like, okay, you know, he was always like, oh, that'd be so great. And I'm like, yeah, it'd be so great. But I would never take it seriously. And that night I was like, okay, let's just go check it out. Let's dip our toes in the water, try out each city for a couple of weeks. And at the end of the summer, like if nothing felt right, then we just stay in Nashville or maybe we move back to LA. They say like when you have kids, you really have to make a choice when they're in like school age. So I felt this freedom, but also like we need to maybe, if we're going to stay somewhere, we need to pick the right place that we want to stay for a long time. So we have basically 5 years or 4 years to knock it out and really find somewhere that we like.
Do you still see, so you don't see Hamburg as like a permanent place at the moment?
No, I do. I'm saying time we were thinking, we need to choose wisely, basically.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, I think Germany, honestly, if people are moving or if people are trying to get out of America, I think Germany is probably one of the top three countries you could move to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this fear and this restriction and stuff that we have with language is like such a small problem in comparison to all of these crazy rewards you get. Like, I'm really interested to dive into your backstory too. Is like, I was also from Mississippi, you're from Georgia. I think we have a similar background in that way. And I'm curious about the life that you had there. And then, I mean, just in my experience, I came here in 2015 and the first year, first 2 years, whatever, like, it's a lot of adjustment, a lot of second guessing if this was the real plan or not, you know, kind of thinking, kind of feeling detached from the surroundings enough to where I could go back if I really wanted to. And then, I don't know, then this sort of thing clicked where I was like, I think it was maybe my first day job paycheck or something where I thought, oh, that's funny. Because I think it was at a cafe or some restaurant. And I thought, I've never been paid this for a cafe or restaurant job in America ever, not once. And I was like, that's really different. You know, then they were like, oh, by the way, you know, your health insurance is covered through the job. So you don't have to worry about, you know, going to the doctor or getting an ambulance or anything like that. And I was like, oh, that's a huge difference there, you know?
Yeah. We felt in a way that we're getting paid to move to Germany. Cause like, okay, public transportation. Yeah. So no car payment. Okay. No car insurance payment. Cool. Cha-ching. And then no health insurance. Well, you know, they say, oh, you do pay health insurance. And we do, but like not nearly.
Right.
It's not the same situation
at all.
For a family of three, we were paying it was $2,500 a month. Yeah.
Plus your car insurance, plus your phone bills, plus your rent, plus water, plus electric.
Everything. So
mortgage,
when we were thinking like, okay, so we put all that on hold. We come here. and it's somewhat, I mean, somehow we're keeping afloat. It's not like, you know, woo, like let's buy a boat.
Sure,
but,
sure.
but yeah,
buy a boat. That's very American. I miss that.
Yeah. But it's good. It feels like the right choice still. I do miss my family. It sucks. I wish they were closer, especially now. I think, like, you know, it's really shitty. My parents were supposed to come and visit in June. It would have been my dad's first trip outside of America. And that's a bummer because I want to show them how beautiful this city is and the life we've made and how there's so many other different trains of thought happening outside of America. And there's so many different cultures and different people. And I mean, I don't know, America's a melting pot, but like where I'm from is very.
But I think, I mean, like on paper, you know, and stuff, and in bigger cities, the country is definitely a melting pot and stuff, but I don't think it's as appreciated. And I think depending where you are, you live in such a bubble and you really, you know, and like, you and I both were, especially being from the South, it was like beaten into us every day at school. I pledge allegiance to the flag. You know, it was such crazy amounts of unnecessary patriotism to force us to really believe for so long that this was the number one greatest country you could ever imagine living in, no matter what. And then you just take a summer in a different country, or like, you know, in our case, a couple of years, and you're like, oh, no. They have lots of problems that they don't talk about. And oh, that's funny how they, you know, that's very political to get into like the rich and poor situation, but just, you just see the issues that you had never really thought about until you saw it from like a different perspective.
Yeah. One thing I noticed, I mean, the obvious thing is healthcare. Like, why wouldn't a country want their citizens to be healthy? Where is the, how does that make any sense? Like, oh, sorry, you're poor. Go fuck yourself. Like, it's, that's one of the huge benefits of being in Germany, but just like a moral benefit, knowing that people are taken care of. If they're not making enough money, they are still going to be helped when they're sick, when all kinds of things. Having a baby is so stressful anyway, but like if you don't have health insurance, that's super expensive, and you get constant like emails and people like sending mail, that thing in your mailbox post. I'm like, what is that thing? It's like paper, it's got some stamps. But yeah, I mean, they you're being attacked. And I was on the phone, even though I had health insurance, I was on the phone constantly with a newborn in my hands, like yelling at someone like, why am I being charged by 15 different people from one hospital that I had this baby in? And it's almost like they confuse you so much. Like the health insurance industry just confuses you so much to be like, okay, I'm going to pay it, whatever.
Just because I would like to see maybe some shock on Mo's face. Would you be comfortable sharing how expensive it was to actually have your baby in a hospital?
I think it was, I want to say $14,000 or $16,000.
Thousand?
Yeah.
Thousand?
Yeah.
What the actual fuck? If you would have said, okay, like $1,400, $1,600, we'd say, okay, still tough, but okay. But $16,000.
Let's talk about that's after I'm paying $700 a month for my own health insurance every month, just to have the freedom of saying, oh, I have health insurance, and paying a deductible of $4,500. So all of that added up. Yes.
And I mean, and God forbid you have any student loans.
And then you're sliding into your child's student college payment or whatever.
It's unimaginable that system is like the norm. And we just bought it. We just thought like that's good. We're fine.
It's pretty trippy. My husband got his appendix randomly. We were in where were we? We were in LA, and we were living in Nashville, but I had a show in LA, and we came, you know, he came with me and I did my sound check, and he's like, oh, my stomach hurts. And I'm like, oh, it's probably just that burrito we ate. And he's like, no, it really hurts. And he's like, I think I need to go to the hospital. So I went on stage and played my show. He got into an Uber and went to Cedars-Sinai Hospital. And I called him after my show, and he's like, yeah, they want to take my appendix out, but they're saying I don't have health insurance. Like, my health insurance isn't reinstated. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So he's on the phone with the health insurance people for like 3 hours while his appendix is rupturing. And they finally figured it out that they had changed his member number or something. And as soon as they realized that he does have health insurance, they took him in, did the surgery, blah, blah, blah. Weeks later, he's awesome, fine. You know, it's a pretty common surgery. But we get the bill in the mail, and it was, it tells you how much it would have cost, like how much insurance paid. And it was an $80,000 surgery that was billed to the insurance companies from the hospital. So $80,000 gets billed to the insurance company, and then the insurance company ends up paying for it. You know, I think my husband, for that, it was around $8,000 that he paid for his appendix being out. But yeah, what? Just.
I mean, oh my God, man.
So then you think, oh my God, it was an $80,000 surgery, but I only have to pay $8,000? Like, okay, this, you know, it's, I don't know.
This really saved my life here. Wow, thanks, health insurance.
The most perverted thing about this is that they ask you about your insurance stuff before they start caring about you, no matter if you had an accident or whatever, and that would never happen in Germany. They obviously ask about your insurance, but they would, no matter if you need an emergency operation or whatever, they would do it and ask you afterwards, hey, what's your insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, they called me. I had to have, as an adult, I learned that I have hydrocephalus, which is like where your brain, it sounds way crazy if I say it out loud, but where the ventricles in your brain, I had like a swelling, it was full of spinal fluid or whatever. And I had to go in and get brain surgery. They call it, you know, it's brain surgery, but they go in and they put a tiny, because it's your brain, they have to put a little tiny hole in where your ventricle is to give it to space to, like, so it doesn't fill up with this spinal fluid, and just so everything can flow better.
Like it drains the fluid out.
Yeah, exactly. So okay. Whatever, because it's your brain, it sounds super intense and scary, and it was. But since this was a long time ago, I feel like it was probably like maybe 10 years ago. It feels less crazy now. I would have never talked about this, you know, when it happened. But yeah, the morning.
Sure, it's scary. Yeah.
It was scary. I passed out. I was having lunch with my sister and I passed out, and I went to the hospital and they did a scan and they're like, you have hydrocephalus. You need brain surgery right now. And I was like, what the fuck? So it was pretty.
Oh my God, man.
It was pretty trippy. Anyway.
It must have been so scary. Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. I mean, but it usually happens with like little, like kids or babies or really old people. So it's random, rare to have it as an adult. But anyway, yeah, I know the health insurance company called me in the morning of the day of my surgery. And I was so nervous. I'm like, are you serious? I'm doing brain surgery. Like, that's crazy. Blah, blah, blah. That morning I get a call from the insurance company. Like, we need you to pay your deductible right now. And I'm like, I'm about to go into surgery. Like, how dare you call me and stress me out about paying?
You said that.
Yeah. And they're like, sorry, rules are rules, ma'am. You know, $4,500. How are you going to pay for this? Visa, MasterCard.
So it didn't matter that you stood up for yourself.
No. So I had to pay it. I put it on my credit card and I went about my surgery and everything was awesome. And I made really good friends with my brain surgeon, and he comes to all the shows with his wife when I play in LA. And it was actually a really pleasant experience. But that morning was ridiculous. That's when I learned, like, oh, okay, there's some pretty evil stuff happening behind the curtain.
That's so unbelievably toxic and
evil. And think about all the other.
It's really evil.
Yeah, for me, I was less offended about it being personal. Like, oh, how dare they do that to me? I was just imagining how upset other people might be and what other predicaments other people might be and how.
Dude, I mean, yeah. I mean, you think about, like, you know, more underprivileged communities, and maybe like a struggling single mother has a baby who needs this surgery, and she's thinking that her whole life is over now because she can't afford it. And then they call on the morning of her baby's surgery that could, you know, maybe even at that young age, save its life. And she has to make the decision, like, how can I pay to save my baby's life? Like, that's so evil. I can't even conceptualize it anymore. Like, it's so, yeah, it leaves me speechless to think about how people can do that. Of course. Yeah, it's almost an interesting yin and yang sort of thing, because the health insurance and, you know, the banking system and, you know, whatever, wherever money is really involved can really put a big pressure down on a lot of people. And I think the yin to that yang is kind of the fact that it makes such strong human communities. You know, I mean, in LA, of course, you probably had a huge community. I know that's the same in a lot of major cities, but, you know, and even in smaller, more underprivileged areas, where that kind of bigger 1% world is pushing down on them, that's why you have like friends that are as strong as family, and you have like 15 people in a big circle, and you're never alone. You can call anyone at 4 a.m. to pick you up anywhere, and you just feel so social, and you feel so connected, and you feel so loved and welcomed, and part of America is something I miss a lot, for sure.
Yeah, I miss walking into a store and be like, hey babe, how you doing, you need help, you know, like,
yes.
Here it's like, absolutely. I walk into a store, I mean, not all the time, but sometimes, and people just, the one thing that I had to really cope with when I first moved here is staring. I felt like I was being stared at all the time.
Yes.
And I've had, you know, I'm like mothering my child. Dude, I'm like, are you judging me? Are you staring? Am I ugly to you? Yes. Am I wearing the wrong clothes? Like, why are you staring at me? And I now have staring contests with people, which I find a lot of fun. Like, I'm like, who's going to look down first? But yeah, I did notice that.
Yeah, it's like a staring. Yeah.
And it's,
I mean, I can't believe you've never noticed that before, but it's like, I thought it was only.
No German does. I ask my friends, like, I'm like, do you ever notice how people just stare? Like, in the South, we call it a hairy eyeball. Like, do you ever get hairy eyeballs? And they're like, what are you talking about? If someone stares at you for too long, it's called a hairy eyeball.
A hairy eyeball.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, but yeah, that was something I've noticed. And, you know, and my husband, he says people yell at him all the time on the when he's riding his bike. Like, people tell him, like, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. I know. I mean, and I know that some people are feeling like there's a lot of good heartedness of it. Like, we're all in this together. Like, if you don't straighten your act up, like, we're all going to fail or something. Like, maybe they're just trying to help everybody be better, I don't know, do better. But I'm just waiting to have someone yell at me, because I've learned a new word from my son, and it is kackawurst. And I'm going to just tell them, du bist ein kackawurst.
You know, I'm sorry to break this to you, but I think we just found the title for your episode.
Yes, thank you.
I'm kidding.
Yeah.
But am I?
No.
Let's touch back a bit on, you know, your kind of unbelievable career before moving to Hamburg, which seems so crazy now, like, after everything that you've accomplished. But I mean, I have to ask you, how was it to play, you know, this, like my dream, you know, like as a kid, I think I had two dream stages to play since I was about 9 years old. And that was the stage of Saturday Night Live and the stage of Conan O'Brien. I mean, how was it to play that show? What was the circumstance like? You know, which record was it for? Like, I want to know everything about this experience because that just blows me away.
So that happened when, okay, I put my first record out in 2007 and independently. And then I had a lot of interest from record labels, which is always weird to me. I mean, I guess they want to take you to the next level or they see that it's working already. So they want to put money behind you to make it really blow up. But it was doing well in 2007, and I had met with a few different labels, and MySpace was really big back then. And so MySpace Records had just started, and they're like, we want you to be our first signing, and like, we guarantee you always like front page stuff, and like, this is the new world of social networking and how you get your music out to so many different people. And I was like, well, this makes total sense. It was only for two records, and they were gonna pay for the record, and you know, it just made sense. And so I did it, and they were on it. They're amazing. They had a really cool PR team a really expensive PR team that they paid for that got me a spot on Conan. And,
crazy.
That was a really surreal moment for me because I grew up watching Conan and I love him so much. And
Of course.
Yeah. So that was for my first record, for the re-release of my first record, which the single Boys with Girlfriends was added on it. And that's right. The song I played on the show.
And who were the guys that you brought with you?
The guys were from L.A., just different people that I'd worked with from LA. Was it Zach Ray? He plays with Death Cab for Cutie.
Man, that's already kind of a dream just to play with him.
Yeah, it was really cool. And then my bass player, Ed Maxwell. The drummer plays with... who was the drummer on that show? I think it was... Yeah, Michael Jerome, who does he play for now? He plays with, I'm blanking, but it's like a 90s rock band, Better Than Ezra.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that was who was the drummer.
So you kind of had a super group.
Yeah, I mean, that happens in LA because, yeah, there's so many amazing artists and we all know each other because we're all playing the same places. And if something like that happens, it's like, hey, you're around. It's like, hell yeah, I'm around Conan O'Brien. Of course.
That's so cool. So like, did you get to spend much time with him after the song, after you performed the song? Or was it really just a short professional, like get in, get out, shake hands?
It was pretty professional, but like he came into the room before it went on and said how happy he was to have me. It was really... really nice. Like he was so nice. And I saw him in a restaurant maybe like a year later. And I went up to him and I was like, I just want to say, you're really great. And I played your show. And he was like, yeah, Miko. Like he remembered my name.
Oh, wow.
So it was, he's so cool. He's a legit human being.
I love whenever I get to hear a good, like a wholesome Conan story because I hold him on such a high pedestal in terms of like morality and humor and like generosity or like genuineness. And as long as that trail keeps going, I have a little bit of hope for humans.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really good. And I haven't played David Letterman, but what I hear is that whole experience is very cold. Like it's literally cold in the building and he doesn't talk to you at all.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, you just play and that's that. But I've only played two late night shows and it's Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien. And they were both really, really, really nice. And so
that was my next really question nice. Was actually, how was it with Leno?
Yeah, same thing. Like I knew what to look forward to and I knew what to focus on because when I did play Conan, I was really, really nervous. And I could see that in the recording, like I was, you know, losing my shit when I was playing. So I just wanted to have more fun and, with Jay Leno and, I don't know, just enjoy the experience a little more and like live in the moment. And, but yeah, he was really cool. He showed us his cars before we went, cause he's a big,
He showed you the cars?
Yeah, he's a vintage car collector. So he's showing us what he drove that day. And yeah.
Wild.
He's,
you know, I always feel like if people get the chance to play, like the level of exposure that it is, or at least even was maybe 10 years ago at this, at that level of, like cable TV late night shows, like, of course, everyone was dying to play Letterman and, you know, Conan is also so loved and Jay Leno was huge. And I think like when you get the chance to play something like that, or in my case, like in my fantasy, it would have been SNL. I feel like I would be so petrified that I wouldn't be able to really like enjoy being there and like enjoy the accomplishment of being there. But like, I would be so worried that my next note would be wrong or that people wouldn't like it, that I would only be aware that I did it long after I had already done it. And then the memory would just be like stress and not the memory of like, I played it.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think that in the moments of doing those two shows, I was very nervous, and I do have pretty big stage fright, especially when I know that it's airing to lots of people. So for me, I tried to remind myself at the time, like, okay, you're really stressed out right now, but just remember to smile, cause this shit's on tape forever. And, and now I think about it and, yeah, at the time it was a whirlwind. I don't know if I truly got to enjoy it, but now I look at it and just think like it's more enjoyable now, I think, than it was in the moment.
How old were you when you did Conan and Leno?
Well, Conan was, let's see, 2000, I'm 38. So Conan was 2008. So 30. And then,
okay, nice.
And then Leno was 2015. So whatever that is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you notice, like, after you performed for the public TV or for cable, did you notice like a really big return to your music from that or no?
Nope.
Really?
Yep. Not at all. Not at all. That's what was really so surprising about it.
Sorry, go ahead.
But did you hear anything about it from your label back then or your PR guys on why you did not have it?
No, I think what those shows are, sadly, I mean, even though you want to believe that I'm sure some people listen to it and said, oh, who's this girl? I want to check her out. I mean, I'm like that when I see people on TV. I think at that time, and maybe even now, it's more of like something to have in your CV or, you know, what is it called? Yeah. Resume. Like, oh, I did resume, this. Yeah. Oh, you did this. So you must be so great. And that must have been so great for you. But no, it really, I didn't see much at all from that. And I mean, basically, we're just in a new time. And if you want to really get your music out there, you need to be added to some stupid Spotify playlist.
Spotify playlist. Ugh. I know, the business is so different now.
Yeah, it's different. It really is. And
sorry, I was just gonna say, like, I guess we're a few years apart, but I also feel this same thing that you felt, you know, growing up, that, you know, if you see a band playing on one of these late night shows or on SNL, like, of course, for me also, that was a huge opportunity to discover whatever this artist was. Like, I remember the very first time I saw Death Cab for Cutie playing Summer Teeth on SNL from their Plans album. And from that moment on, I became like blindingly obsessed and became a humongous fan, and like immediately went to, in my town, it was Walmart, like bought the album, you know? And the same thing for a few years later in Louisiana. I think it was like the first band, one of the first bands Jimmy Fallon had when he started his show. And it was Beach House played Zebra. And I was like, oh my God, this sounds crazy. This sounds really different from what people are doing. And I obsessed and I downloaded their record from iTunes, I guess. Now that was already the trending thing. And, you know, and then recently, it's so different now. Like, I guess it's been, maybe it's been like another 10 or 13 years or something later. I was here at home in Munich and was watching like replayed clips of Stephen Colbert's show. And was seeing Wolfpack play their song, I think it's 1812. And in my head, I was watching them and I was like, I wonder if there's someone at home that, like I was as a kid watching them and freaking out and like finding who they are. But nowadays they would just download the record on Spotify.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting too, the impact of commercials, like having your song on a commercial is another way to get your music out there. Yeah, so for the late night shows, it looks and sounds amazing, and it's such a cool accolade to have. But if you want real listeners, it's just getting your song on a I don't know, Apple commercial. Or
I was gonna say, like, speaking of this, because now we're touching into licensing, and I have to really what's the proper, you know, you'll notice this, that the longer you live here, you forget more English, but like, I have to like pay my respects to your extreme achievement with licensing. I mean, your roster for licensing is kind of mind blowing for an indie musician. You like Grey's Anatomy and like Vampire Diaries. And I wrote down a few here, like, oh yeah, One Tree Hill. I remember that show. Like, you kind of blew up. Would you say that? From, like, first off, how did an independent musician get licensed in so many shows? And also, was that more return for you? Like, did you see more fans coming from that as opposed to the late night shows?
Definitely a million times more, or whatever more, a lot more. especially the Grey's Anatomy. I mean, at the time,
that was huge.
That was huge. First of all, I was a waitress at the Hotel Cafe, which is a cool little music venue in LA. And when people would cancel or whenever there was an open spot, they would say, "Miko, you want to play?" And I'm like, "Hell yeah." And so I would always just fill in, and then I'd get off stage and I'd start work again. So it was an interesting time. But in one of those first shows, I played some new songs, and this woman came up to me afterwards and said, "Hi, I'm Lynn Grossman. I work with Grey's Anatomy. And would you mind if that first song you played, do you think I could submit it for one of their shows?" And I was like, "I would not mind that at all. I think that would be a real nice idea." And when it aired, it was the season. So it was my song Reasons to Love You. And it was the season premiere of the third season premiere.
I think must have had millions of viewers.
Yeah. I didn't have a TV, so I couldn't watch it. But I got online and I watched my MySpace page. And I saw that the plays were like 100 or 200. And I saw it go to like a million that night. And what? I knew that was it. Like, that's how you get people to listen. That's the
that's
recipe.
That's unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah.
It must have felt amazing. I mean, that must have just been like your dream.
It was the I made it feeling. I was like, I made it. I need to call home. Yeah.
You take a screenshot from mom and dad. Like, I told you I could do it.
Yeah. I'm somebody. It was very cool. I mean, you know, and then after that, I went back to work I think the coolest thing about any sort of successes like that is just, or the most important part of a success like that is just remembering that you still have, you're that's just a one-off and it's not going to last forever. And you just have to keep grounded and, you know, I don't know, keep on doing what you're doing and not get, you know, big headed and just be like, well, I guess it's time to cash out. Like, you have to keep going if it's a career. And,
there's a little bit of a delay, and I'm really not trying to cut you off like at those so sharply. But that's that thought, like, oh man, I did it again. I'm sorry. You finish your thought and then I'll go.
My thought is, these kinds of things happen few and far in between. Sometimes it happens in a cluster. It's a lot of things that happen at once. But it's good to remember that it's not going to keep happening forever. And if this is your career and this, like, you have to space out your financial situation, you can't just go and think like, oh, you've made it. Like, you have to be really smart about things. And especially as an independent artist, because who's going to pay for the next record? So you just have to be smart about things and not get too, you know, you can be happy and you can celebrate, but not get like, not hang up your hat at Grey's Anatomy.
Exactly. I think it's actually important to emphasize that point of yours for the musicians who listen to this, because I think for indie musicians, it's really important to acknowledge that for every, and probably this is in your case too, I don't know, but in my case for sure, for every one like great leap and bound that you get, in your case, Grey's Anatomy or Conan, or in like in my experiences, like when you get like this one great thing, you've had like at least 150 no's, you know, minimum. For whatever you've tried to do with that song or that record or that image you're building, like getting to that one really great yes, there's just so many no's. So like, it's great to keep level-headed, because when you get that one yes, it's not over. There's at least 1,000 more no's coming. You
so
just have
many
to like work to that next yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Even now, like I put out records and people say like, oh, this is really good, but what I really like is your first record. And that's the hardest thing to hear. Because you're like, I've grown. I am more of a woman now. I am smarter now. And I'm writing smarter lyrics. And I know that I am. But, you know, whatever. That's the one like little bit of a dagger that pushes in every time a record comes out. But and I'm not bitter.
I get that too, though. I think that's really common. Like I think I have like just a really small fraction of the same kind of listening attention that you have, but I still have the same problem, which is that like my two most streamed tracks are from my very first, one is from my very first record and one is from the EP that came out just after. And those were both, one was 7 years ago and one was like 6 years ago. And I don't even play the same genre. That was like kind of country. And now I'm definitely more into like kind of indie pop, and like I don't even play those songs anymore, and they're the most streamed things I have, and I'm like, damn it, that's not representative of me at all.
Yeah, it's funny, but yeah. And then some people have grown with me, and I don't know, but yeah, it's an adventure. And what do they say? It's like it's a marathon, not a race. There's something there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you want to just keep your breath right. And I don't know.
Can I ask, where Miko comes from? Cause you have you and your sister had this kind of thing with the name, right? And I want to know a bit more like your childhood, a little bit where you got the name. You have a grandmother, right? Who was Japanese.
I am a quarter Japanese. My mom's half Japanese. And we were raised by our father, who's Mr. White Guy. Love him, but you know, in
is
a
his
very
name Tad.
Yeah. Yes. No. So we grew up in a really small town where there was just, you know, it was pretty divide, like right down the middle, half black, half white. There was no anything else really when we were growing up. And so we felt very proud of our Japanese heritage, and there were no Asian people
in
our town.
This was in Roberta, Georgia, right?
Yeah. Roberta, Georgia used to be population 808. But yeah, it was a really small town, and we had little nicknames for each other, Miko and Kiko, just to keep our, just to feel like we were connected with our Japanese heritage. And, I would go to camp every year, and I would always sign up as Miko and tell people like, yeah, you're going to remember this name one day. You know, I was like 11 telling.
Wow.
So when I signed up for my first open mic night, I just thought, it was just natural for me to sign in as Miko, and that was it.
Yeah, you find comfort in that for sure, because you think about your family and you think about home, and
yeah,
it makes so much sense to do that.
Yeah, it was good, and I feel happy with that choice, and now, yeah, years later, it's very, you know, Miko is
the spelling of Miko in Germany is, I'm sure, very problematic for you.
I'm Miko all day. It's problematic in Japanese too, because I spell it wrong in Japanese, oddly enough. Well, not really oddly, because I grew up with my dad, so I didn't have my mom's influence really to tell me that I was spelling it wrong. And my grandmother died when I was 10. And so there was no Japanese people around to be like, you're spelling your name wrong. But yeah, even in Japanese, it's pronounced Meiko. And Miko would be either M-I-K-O or M-I-E-K-O.
Ah, okay, okay. So it's the spelling and the pronunciation.
In German, yeah. So I'm just spelling it wrong everywhere.
Were your parents, like, were they ever together? Was it like a boyfriend-girlfriend thing when you were born? Or how was
Yeah, no, they were together. My parents divorced when I was 3. And I lived with my mom for a while, and then she got remarried and kind of wanted to start her own life. And so I moved in with my dad, and I didn't see my mom from then on. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's hard. I know a few friends who had the same situation. Like, did for you as a young girl, was it like hard for you to not have that really close, like, mom person in your
it
life?
Or my
for
balls. You, was it was terrible. It was sucked major donkey balls, but you just kind of move. You know, for me, it was music. My dad plays guitar, and he taught me a few chords as a 12-year-old. And I sat down in my teenage angst and played songs about how sad I was about really, you know, feeling alone and feeling abandoned. And that's when I crafted my song. So I'm very grateful for that. And, you know, my mom is she's super religious and wanted to start on a new path. And, you know, I don't know. It's like I don't want to say cult, but, you know, it's very super religious. Oh, very interesting.
Is it Scientology?
No, it's not. You know, she studies the New Testament or the Old Testament. And she, her whole thing was she wanted to surround herself with people who believe the same things she does. And so it was kind of her and my stepfather, and they had a baby together, and they just wanted to start a new life, which was really hard to deal with. But now I feel, honestly, I'm really happy that it all worked out, because I'm really close to my dad. My dad's married to an amazing woman who he married when I was 11. So, I've had a really cushy family life, and because my mom is, you know, decided to do all that, that sucks. But I also think about what would it be like if she was in my life, and, that would have caused a different kind of stress and, you know, maybe, yeah, would have probably changed everything. And my dad gave me a lot of confidence and a lot of freedom generally, and definitely with music. So I'm happy about how it worked out.
Yeah. It kind of seems like everything went into the right place that it should. And I think angst is like such an incredible fuel for a young person's songwriting. Actually, speaking of your songwriting, I saw, that you have this, I wouldn't say this was like a philosophy, but like, this was the way that you started, which was that you would learn a new chord. And then that for you was like, okay, now I can do a whole new song. That's exactly how I was. I promise you. I was learning, like, I had like G, C, whatever, that was a G, C song. It was like G, C, and D. Boom. Now I got a G, C, D song. And then it was like, oh, there's A minor now. We got E minor in here. And it was the same way.
And then you can write a bunch of different songs with the same chords. You just take the the capo up and around.
Yes, the capo, dude. The capo has been my best friend for many years. And have you ever seen like the Bob Dylan songbook that has? I think he actually made it. I think he printed it through his company. But it's like a little black book, and it's a good amount of his songs, and he's like, here's all of these, like, you know, top 10 Billboard hits from the last 50 years, and they have the same five chords. It's unbelievable what you can do.
Yeah, stick with what works.
Yeah.
Who was it? Hendrix, I guess, who said any song that has more than three chords is jazz.
Oh, yeah. I like that. Yeah,
I love the phrase where I love the one where it's like, jazz musicians play a million chords for three people. Pop musicians play three chords for a million people.
Ooh, hey, that's really good. I like that one.
It's not mine. I'm gonna store that one in my
brain. Nice.
Actually, I was trying to figure out if I had any more questions here. Oh yeah, actually, I did want to touch on. Did you grow up Baptist?
No, I grew up.
Okay.
No, my dad was, yeah, I grew up with a hippie dad, but the only way to socialize as a kid was to go to church camps, and after like Sunday Bible school and stuff, that was when you saw your friends. So I did go to Baptist churches, but I also went to Methodist and Evangelistic, and I was a church hopper just for the free cookies, basically. No. No, a lot of friends
for the wine and oyster crackers.
Yeah. The wine. But yeah. So no, I didn't grow up.
Because I saw that, like, you like your first performance was singing in a Baptist church, right? That was like one of your first probably performances, I guess, when you were younger, right?
Yeah, that was my first performance. I was 8. And my sister's teacher invited us to her church, and it was all Black Southern Baptist church. And
excellent.
It was their Christmas sermon session something. And she asked me if I wanted to sing, and I was like, yeah, I have a song. And I sang I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. And and now I think about that story and how funny that was. And she, you know, of course, she was so supportive, like, okay, baby, go ahead. But I think of that, like, oh my God, that must have been so funny for people, like, who's this white girl, this white kid singing about how she wishes for a white Christmas?
But, white Christmas, I mean, yeah.
I was very supported.
Yeah. You must have come off so innocent to them. I love that.
Yeah, she Miss Dickie, that's who got me there. She has a tape of it, and I hiccup in the middle. I was so nervous, and it was very cute.
Oh, that's extremely embarrassing. That's so cute.
Yeah.
I saw that, and I asked because my family is Southern Baptist. So when I was until about 16 or so, or maybe, yeah, 15 or 16, I was going to the, like, church with them a lot. I think maybe after puberty, I started kind of distancing a little bit mentally from, maybe it was the church I was going to or the whole thing in general. But by the time I was a teenager and stuff, then yeah, they also don't go as often anymore. And then I haven't gone years.
Yeah. That's what happens sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you come here and you're like, oh, everything here is Catholic. I'm not Catholic. So
I don't even witness any sort of religious stuff here, except for the beautiful old churches. But like, I don't feel like I'm getting any religious vibes from anyone.
Okay. See, whenever you come play a gig or take a visit through Munich, first off, we would love to hang out with you. And second of all, you'll notice it here in Bavaria. It's like extraordinarily Catholic. They have their own holidays. They have everything is conservative. They don't do anything on Sundays. Maybe that's also in Hamburg though.
Yeah. It's everything's closed on Sundays. I would say that's pretty big.
That's the religious. Yeah. That's for religion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And many of the holidays, I guess they also have in Hamburg because many of them are German white. But one last thing I have in mind, mm-hmm. I want to talk about is, we already talked about your Japanese heritage, and the first thing Jordan told me about you when he got this our little conversation fixed was nothing about this, but yeah, Mikko is this musician which had quite success in Japan. How did that come?
Right.
And yeah, is there a correlation to your heritage, or is it just a random thing?
It's no, it's not random. So I signed with a record label called Concord Records. And in the first meeting, before I actually signed the contract, they were like, so what's your dream? What do you want to happen? And I was like, well, I'm a quarter Japanese. I really want to connect with my Japanese heritage. And is it possible, like, you guys could focus on getting this record out in Japan? And I would love to tour there. So they did that. And yeah, my song, it was for my record, The Bright Side. And my song, Stuck on You, was number one on the radio there for, I want to say, 12 weeks.
And, what?
Yeah. I played That's the huge. Billboard Music Awards. Yeah, it was a very fun time to be Holy in Japan.
Holy moly.
Totally Lost in Translation vibes, if you've seen that movie.
Yes. Yeah.
But it was very cool. And the first show that I played that was near where my grandmother was from, my family of like 15 people, but took a bus to come and see me, and they surprised me, and I lost
That's
it.
That's so
it was
sweet.
Very oh cool. God. Yeah. Like meeting cousins that were my age, and you know, I didn't speak Japanese. They didn't speak English, but we just connected. And we just, a lot of tears. It was very cool. Yeah.
Which city were you in mostly?
Well, you said mostly?
Yeah, like you went to Japan, right?
Yeah, Tokyo was the main place that I played. But then okay. I went all over. And my family's from Sapporo, which is north.
Okay. I just asked like which place you stayed in longest because I wanted to know if you knew this artist, Stu Larsson.
No, I don't, but that doesn't, okay. I mean, I don't know a lot of, I'm not very hip to new music or.
I just, yeah, he's a talented guy, and he kind of like got a bit of a bigger break playing there. And now he's kind of, you know, Passenger. He's kind of like Passenger's number one. Like they tour a lot together. And then Stu did a show here in Munich that sold out. And I luckily got onto the support for that and met him there. And he's a really, really friendly guy. And I wanted to ask you, I saw on your Instagram that you're followed by Kobe Grant. Are you guys friends?
Yeah, we are. She's so cool. And we just became friends, I guess, I don't have a clue how we became friends. But she played in Hamburg and she invited me to the show. And she's really cool. And we instantly got along. She's great.
Absolutely. She did a show here last March, I think. And then I wrote her on Instagram if she needed support. She said yes. I played the show. And we became friends too. And actually, we've had her on the show. She was a guest also.
That's so cool. Yeah, she's great.
She's great. Kobe's so friendly, mm-hmm. so talented.
Yeah.
And shout interesting. Out to Kobe.
Funny.
We're big fans.
Yeah, cool.
Well, I think, honestly, from my side, I think that might be all I really wanted to jump into, unless you have any other questions on your mind, Mo.
One last question. I watched quite some interviews of yours, which I found online. One happened in the same room you're sitting now. There was only another guitar standing next to the bed, but the same situation. And I was wondering because you mentioned this situation at the bakery in Hamburg, and in this interview, it a month ago or two, you did this kind of a YouTube thing, and you told there you're into baking your own bread. How does it come you still go to the bakery? Is your success with baking your own bread so small?
Wait, no, I'm a shitty bread baker. But it's also...
I was like, wait, what?
So basically, yeah, I tried it. I've only tried a few times, like maybe 4 or 5 loaves. They've been all right, but it's a lot of work. You know, it's a lot easier to go downstairs and see Mrs. Frau Bruchen and and order the bread.
So still a big task during this crazy times.
Yeah, if we go on lockdown again, I'm gonna be head bread maker again. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, we tried one here, and it took a lot of extra work. But I got to say, if it comes out decent, then you're kind of hooked on it. We really can't wait to do it again.
I'm going to send you this recipe that I have. That it's a New York Times. It's called No Need Bread. It's really easy to make. And it's really, really good. I have two recipes I'll send you.
Awesome. Yeah, send it to me. That'd be great. Well, cool. Then, Miko, we can't thank you enough for spending this time. We know you have a young son at home, and it means a lot that you found the time to talk to us about your life and your career and everything. And we really wish you all the best, super success in Hamburg. And please, honestly, anytime you come through Munich, let me know if, I don't know, if you need a place to stay or if you want to get beer somewhere. Would love to see you.
Yeah. Same to you. If you need a place to stay, we have a guest room in our little apartment. Somehow it's a small apartment, but it's divided up into micro rooms. So you have a,
oh, that's cool.
But if you want to catch up and get a beer next time you're here, let me know.
Awesome. Okay. All right, Miko. Thanks a lot. Sweet. Take care.
Thank you.
I think we're going to hang up here.
Das ist hang alles.
All right. Take care.
Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. See you later.
Bye, Miko.
Bye.
Wow, Moritz, what a great interview that was, huh?
I actually loved it and loved her for the things she said. She said, super honest, super real, learned a lot of things through this.
Absolutely.
A real artsy-fartsy immigrant.
She was a genuine artsy-fartsy immigrant, yeah. Thank you, Miko, again. That was a lot of fun to talk to you, and thank you guys for listening so much. If you enjoyed today's show, please go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to this show. Give us a like, a review, or a share, or even just tell a friend about it, because word of mouth goes a long way for shows like this. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Look out, baby. The Saints are
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von Jordan Prinz und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.